Screen Time with John Fardy.
Thanks to Airtainment, a new era in Irish streaming begins. Discover more at airtainment.com.
This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, the one and only Angela Bassett talks about playing the president in Zero Day, as well as her long career playing everyone from Tina Turner to Queen Wakanda. We review the new stylish horror, The Monkey, as well as the new Apple TV Beckettian drama, The Gorge. Plus, the Dublin International Film Festival is underway, and we hear all about what's happening from director Gráinne Humphreys. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the News Talk app powered by Go Loud or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all, and I do hope you're doing well. I got a lot of interactions from listeners and other people about talking to Robert De Niro last week, and a couple of people pointed out when he said, "I'm going to look you up when I come to Ireland," it sounded vaguely threatening. I suppose it did when I watched it back. It's fun though. And also a lot of people enjoyed the kind of profile we played of him. However, a couple of people said, "You never mentioned Midnight Run," and I didn't. I don't know why. Time didn't allow, I guess. But that is one of the great Robert De Niro movies, opposite the late, great Charles Grodin, where he's bringing Charles Grodin across the country to cash in bail bonds. It's a brilliant film and a kind of, you know, undiscovered, just not a lot of people know about it, or as many people as they should. Midnight Run is brilliant Robert De Niro movie. So that was all last week. This week, I suppose the big news was the IFTAs and indeed the BAFTAs. You know, with the IFTAs, Cillian Murphy was there, Saoirse Ronan was there, the cast to Say Nothing, Kneecap. You know, and this is no disrespect to the IFTAs. They won't mind me saying this, but you know, many years ago, that awards event seemed like, you know, why are we bothering with this? We're kind of squeezing the water out of the cloth here and there's not enough water in it. By God, there's enough water in that cloth now. Just the level of talent who we were celebrating and were given awards at the IFTAs this week. You know, they're world class. Saoirse Ronan, Cillian Murphy, Kneecap. This was an awards ceremony that could hold its own with any, I have to say. So nice to see, you know, the Irish film and TV industry in such good health, as represented by the IFTAs last week. And of course, a lot of people talked about the BAFTAs. Conclave did very well. So, you know, is this going to be a surprise for the Oscars? I really don't think so. I still think The Brutalist is going to win Best Movie. And there was much talk about Mikey Madison winning for Anora, where she plays the sex worker who marries the son of a Russian oligarch. A worthy winner, but I still think Demi Moore is going to win for The Substance, because that is a Hollywood story, Demi Moore winning. I mean, there was disappointment for Kneecap. They did win Best Director, but you know, Kneecap will be fine. And you know, they've said this week they're not doing any more movies or anything. They really don't need to. They are a brand now. Not that they want to be, but their future is bright, no doubt. So that was the IFTAs and indeed the BAFTAs. Now to TV, and this week I was watching this.
I was diagnosed with a stage 4 brain tumour.
Really?
Yes.
You have medical records that prove that you have terminal brain cancer.
I'll have them sent to you.
Okay, good. If you were lying, if you'd gotten confused along the way, you're here asking for my professional advice and guidance. This is a no-judgment space.
Go on, then. Guide me.
Best case on what I gotta go on. You go dark, you change your name, you get a good lawyer, you should have one already.
I can't abandon my company, heck. You know what it's like. I have staff and backers. Not to mention momentum that is unquantifiable.
It's gone. Forget about it.
Okay, look, I'm not here for your legal advice or your business help.
Then why are you here?
I've come to you specifically because I want my reputation back.
Yes, that is a clip from the much talked about series on Netflix, Apple Cider Vinegar. And that was the actress Kathleen Dever playing the real life person, Bella Gibson. Bella Gibson was and is very wealthy lady at one stage in her career because she pretended she had brain cancer. And she set up a whole business, the whole pantry, all about selling healthy food, had a massive online following. Then the wheels started to come off when people slowly realised that she hadn't been sick at all. The brilliant Kathleen Dever plays her and does a brilliant job. And this series, we did it on Pat Kenny during the week in Box. Pat had watched one episode and couldn't wait to watch the rest of them, is a brilliantly rendering of this story, of this poor unfortunate woman. And I say poor unfortunate woman because she tricked people and it was a horrendous thing to do, but she had some pretty sad stuff in her own life that seemed to give rise to this. And anyone who wants to tell such a lie as that can't be all that well, I would have to say. And the story is told brilliantly because it looks at her childhood. It starts with the kind of present where she's falling apart and the lie is out. It shows us her settling on the idea of pretending she might be sick, and then her initial attempts to set up a business. In tandem with that, we have another story, a young lady called Milla Blake, who had cancer and was attempting a juice diet to cure this cancer, and also set up a business and got a whole millions of followers and was quite successful for some time, and was genuinely sick and attempted to tell the world about how juices were helping her with her battle in cancer. And they become kind of opposing people in this series, let's say. And what I really like about this is that it's a bit messy at the start, like it goes back, it goes forward, but it all comes together very quickly, coalesces in a very pleasing storytelling way. And I was talking to a couple of people on the floor, and it's very bingeable. You really want to see where this story goes. It's only 5 episodes. Bella Gibson had a very complicated childhood. Her mother was pretty awful to her and still continues to be. She was very beguiling at times to people. And one of the characters says at one point she didn't have friends, she had hosts. And she's very good at inveigling her way into people's lives and getting what she needs from them. Now, a lot of the time she appears to be doing this for the benefit of her own child, who she doesn't want to have a rough childhood, this young boy, who she gives birth to with a guy that really in a weird kind of relationship, she subsequently meets someone else. So it is brilliantly told storytelling, I have to say. Apple cider vinegar. You know, people are saying it's a death knell for the wellness industry. I think that might be overstating it. It's certainly a death knell for people who pretend to have cancer and then try and sell food on the result of it. But you would herald that death knell, I would hope. But that is Apple Cider Vinegar on Netflix, now streaming. Well, well worth a watch. Let me know what you might have been watching. John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. The biggest thing happening in Irish cinema this week, and indeed international, is the Dublin International Film Festival, which started on Thursday of this week, the 20th of February. And you know you're a success when you're known by your initials, D-I-F-F, Diff. I long for the days when I'll just be introduced as J-F. But that's Sinn Scéal Ella, delighted to be joined now by Gráinne Humphreys, Executive Director, erstwhile Executive Director, I would suggest, of Diff. Gráinne, how are you?
I'm great, actually. I'm in good shape. I mean, it's a funny job. You know, you spend your year watching films, and then, as I said, for these 11 days, you watch other people do that.
Yes, indeed, indeed. Well, look, try and enjoy it as well, not to sound like your mother or something like that. Tell me this. We're talking now. It's up and running 2 days. Ralph Fiennes was in for The Return, Pasolini's The Return. So that was the big opening film. A good reception for that? I imagine you wouldn't be starting the film festival without a great movie to start.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's funny because it is one of the kind of key tasks, I suppose, is to find the film that kind of sets the tone. I mean, in a way, it's maybe a personal choice. I did classics in school and classics in college. So I've been waiting for someone to do a decent Odysseus story for a very, very long time. And I'm a huge fan of Ralph Fiennes. He's been a festival guest, I think, 3 times. And himself and Juliet Binoche have, you know, played opposite each other a number of times. So, you know, Odysseus, Penelope, it did feel like a kind of obvious choice. But also you're aware that, you know, that film kind of sets off the festival, you know, in different directions. And again, the idea of kind of returning home, you know, for some filmmakers, that's what Diff is. And for others, you know, it's a kind of patient wait for something else. So I kind of liked the idea that the kind of first film was going to be about some of the emotions that people might experience over the course of the festival.
Yeah. And then to go right to the end, but we're closing with Four Mothers, Darren Thornton with Fionnuala Flanagan. What's going on in that one? Because again, a movie that closes the festival, presumably there's a lot going on in it.
It is. It absolutely is. But again, it's a kind of personal thing. I love finishing on a comedy or something that's very happy and kind of warm and kind of, if you like, sends our audiences out into the night and the rest of the year. Do you know what I mean? With a kind of warmth and optimism. And it's just a beautiful film. I mean, the kind of subject is something that probably people of a certain age will be familiar with, which is kind of, you know, caring for aging parents and wanting to be, you know, true to yourself, but also, you know, very much connected to looking after those who brought you into the world. And it's about a guy who effectively kind of gets in some ways dumped by his friends with their mothers. And so it's about a kind of a weekend where, you know, he is the man with four mothers. So it's as I said, very warm, very witty, beautifully cast. And again, a film that I genuinely think will have a big smile on people's faces as they leave the cinema on Sunday week.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things I admire about the festival is, you know, you're drawing big names every year. And one, I suppose, that really stands out this year is Twiggy, who you might necessarily think would be someone you'd be celebrating coming to a film festival. But why is Twiggy there? And God bless her, but why is she there?
Well, there's a number of things. I mean, one is that I am a nerd. You know, I grew up on BBC Two afternoons with kind of film noir and then watching Moviedrome on Saturday nights. And so I really like when you have parts of the festival that kind of celebrate, you know, actors or directors from the cinema kind of canon, from, you know, the history. And so Sadie Frost has made this lovely documentary, a very warm sort of portrait of Twiggy, about the film roles, you know, the boyfriend, the work that she did, you know, with Ken Russell and the different kind of incarnations in her kind of long life. And then Twiggy agreed to come to the festival. And if, I feel like, you know, this is an opportunity to hear, you know, Twiggy and Sadie talking about themselves, about their lives, about their careers. And again, it's something I love about film festivals is parallel to the screenings, is people talking about how they, you know, found certain roles or they found certain subjects. I'm kind of always interested in the kind of cinema history piece. And I'm just, you know, delighted that, as I said, somebody who has, a really rich and very varied life is coming to talk about it.
Yeah. Now, Jessica Lange and Ed Harris will be there as well. And they're there for Long Day's Journey Into Night, as well as getting awards, rightly so. And this is, of course, the adaptation of the Eugene O'Neill lauded play.
It is. I mean, I think I was talking actually to Erica Rowe, who's an Irish actress who's actually in the film with Jessica and Ed. And, you know, it is one of the big theatrical, you know, parts and pieces is this kind of dysfunctional family and this the kind of painful kind of conflict between them. And it is, you know, a role that Jessica Lange had played on Broadway and it was made in Ireland last year. And I think it's just lovely that, you know, that we're kind of reuniting the family nearly to come back to celebrate the screen version of it. But also Jessica Lange, I mean, from, you know, from Tootsie or The Postman Always Rings Twice to Sweet Dreams to Frances, you know, even to the later Ryan Murphy kind of phase of her career. I think she's fantastic. And I mean, and Ed Harris, you know, is again, somebody who I genuinely have followed for many, many years and loved, you know, his innate ability, if he's not the leading man, to steal any scene that he's in. And Pollock, the film that he directed about Jackson Pollock, is a really wonderful piece of work. So again, you know, as you said, worthy recipients of our Volta Awards.
Yeah. Now, from an Irish perspective, one that really caught my eye, a football comedy starring Ardal O'Hanlon called Fran the Man.
Well, I've had one constant refrain from audiences, which is, oh, God, Grania, not more long, boring, depressing films about poverty and pain. And I go, yes. Well, if filmmakers would like to make some happy, optimistic, warm-hearted films that will bring a kind of energy and light into our lives, I will show them. And, you know, one of the reasons when Colin McCarthy, the producer, kind of, you know, got in contact, you know, said this is a film that will, you know, bring in different audiences. You know, they're football fans, they're comedy fans. It's a great cast. You know, Amy Huberman, Deirdre O'Kane. There's a wonderful kind of range of different characters, but there's also a kind of maybe very kind of like Dublin humor as well at its heart.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's what I think the Dublin International Film Festival has to do, is to remember where it is, where it comes from, you know, and to try and reflect back to our audiences, do you know what I mean? The kind of stories that they may be very familiar with, as well as all the other wonderful kind of international kind of storytellers who are coming to the festival.
Yeah. Now, talking of stories we may be familiar with, I've known Ross Whittaker a long time. And as long as I've known him, it's no exaggeration to say he's been talking to me anyway about a documentary about the Lotto Syndicate in the 90s. And that's no exaggeration. I think I've known him 20 years, and certainly for the last 12 years, he's mentioned this on occasion whenever I've been speaking to him, and sometimes didn't even want to mention it because he was so bogged down it. And I was delighted to read only this week, it's getting its debut at TIFF, Beat the Lotto.
I love this film, and you're absolutely right. I mean, Ross is not only, you know, a lovely, brilliant kind of member of the film community and always up for a Q&A or hosting a panel, but he's a really great filmmaker. And so, you know, it was an honor to be able to show Beat the Lotto in the festival. You know, to us, that's like one of my dreams, is to include one of Ross's films. And I love this film. I mean, even just thinking about it makes me smile. You know, it's like a heist movie. It's about a gang getting together and trying to outwit a system. It's brilliantly done. It's tense. If you know the story, you'll just watch it with your eyes wide open in amusement. If you don't, you'll be just shocked, going, how on earth did this actually happen? Which, you know, again, I think is going back to that idea of kind of playing with people's expectations, you know, that is, sometimes people think that documentaries can be somewhat kind of, you know, dour or dark. And this is very definitely something that I think will bring in a lot of audiences that are just pulled in by the sheer kind of excitement of the actual subject. And it's brilliantly made.
Yeah. Now, tell me this, not to put you on the spot, but have you seen every movie that's screening and every documentary?
Yes.
Excellent. Excellent. Because, you know, I get regularly, all you do is go to the cinema every week. That's not working. You have literally spent the last couple of months watching movies more or less every day, right?
Yeah. I mean, the thing I would say is that we had 24% more films than we did last year. And we have a screening team. So we watch everything and then we shortlist and then we watch again. And that is a lot of work. And I'm very conscious for filmmakers, it's a really tough world out there because, you know, there's a lot of competition. And, you know, what's really important for me is that when we put a film in, that we're able to do something for that film, that it'll connect with a Dublin/an Irish audience, that we'll be able to support it. And if it's a new film starting its journey internationally, that we're able to get critics or programmers to see it. So, you know, I feel like it's not maybe what the festival was 20 years ago, you know, where it's like an opportunity to see something, do you know what I mean, that's not coming back. I mean, actually, the festival now has turned into something that, you know, there's a status to being in the festival. And it's very important that we kind of, you know, manage that, as well as the expectations of the filmmakers. And of course, the people paying for the tickets, the audience.
Oh, absolutely. Who will no doubt have a good time. So, the simplest way, I'm assuming, if people want to go to any of these things, and we have literally only scratched the surface because there's so much more we could have talked about, but diff.ie for tickets, or how do you want people to get their tickets?
I think that's the best way. I'm old fashioned. I'm the person who sits with a brochure and a coffee, you know, and makes circles around the ones that I want to see and then try to chart my way through it. And I know some of our season passes and people who've taken packages, which are all there, you know, that's one way. Another way is to pick a kind of path. So, you know, there's an Avalon World Cinema program, and that's 8 films. You would have a fantastic time if you actually just saw those. But my piece of advice is always the same, is to pick one you think you like and then pick one that you would never book in a million years. And it's amazing how you might discover something just by that kind of, you know, including that extra title.
Yeah, that's great advice. Well, the festival runs until the 2nd of March. It contains riches for the cinema lover and indeed the documentary lover in your life. And who isn't? So diff.ie, check it out, get your tickets. It's a pleasure, as always, to talk to Executive Director Gráinne Humphreys. Gráinne, thanks a million.
Thanks very much, John. That was great fun. Thank you.
Up next, the one and only Angela Bassett, chatting about playing the president. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. Now last week, I was talking to Robert De Niro about this.
3,402 people died on zero day. Plane crashes, train derailments, total chaos.
Whoever's responsible for this attack, they're dangerous and they say they're going to do it again.
Congress is authorizing a special investigatory commission and endowing it with powers of surveillance, search and seizure.
You're just going to grab people off the streets without warrants.
Actually, you are.
Yes, Angela Bassett opposite Robert De Niro there in Zero Day, the new series that landed on Netflix this week, the 20th of February. As we mentioned last week, Zero Day is all about a dreadful cyber attack that hits America and turns the place rather chaotic. Angela Bassett plays the president who's in charge at the time, and she hires in a former president, Mullen, played by Robert De Niro, to try and sort out Zero Day. And this is, we didn't really fully review it last week because there was an embargo. This is brilliant, gripping TV. It's six parts long. It deals with De Niro's character, Mullen, trying to sort out who's responsible for Zero Day. There's a brilliant supporting cast. Angela Bassett as the American president. Jesse Plemons plays De Niro's gopher right-hand man, who's absolutely brilliant in it. Matthew Modine is in there as well. And, you know, this is getting rave reviews and it's one of those shows that is worthy of six episodes. Like, there's a reason they didn't make a movie out of this. It belongs as a long-form TV show. It's a brilliant watch, rightly getting great reviews. As I say, Angela Bassett is one of the characters in it and the characters all have good backstories, brilliantly told. She plays the American president in charge of all this chaos who hires in the former American president to help her with the job. Angela Bassett is an acting legend, I have to say. At the young age of 66, she has been in everything from What's Love Got to Do with It, playing Tina Turner, all the way up to Queen Wakanda in Black Panther. She started, a lot of people remember, from Boys in the Hood. She's been on TV, 9-1-1, she can currently be seen in or in recent episodes, Waiting to Exhale. She has 5 honorary degrees. Honorary doctorates. Can you imagine? She went to Yale, as it happens. I don't know if that has anything to do with her honorary doctorate. She was in Malcolm X as well. She is a wonderful actress who I had the pleasure of speaking to about Zero Day and a bit more besides. Hi, Angela. John Fardy from News Talk Radio in Dublin, Ireland.
Dublin. Hi, John.
That's it. That's it. You did my accent. We're off to a great start.
I love it. I love your accent.
Well, I loved you in Zero Day, so we're off to a really good start. Tell me this, you know, I wonder, you know, on some level, is there some wish fulfillment thing as a woman where you get a script and you can be the president of America? Like before you even read it and you realize Robert De Niro is in it, does some part of you think, I get to play the president. That would be great.
Absolutely. It's sort of, you know, a dream that you know will never come true for yourself. You know, not that, you know, that those offices and people who serve in those particular ways I have respect for, because I think ultimately they are there to serve people and to serve communities. And I think there's something, you know, notable and noble in that pursuit. I certainly will hope so. The best of me hope so. So to see that, knowing that the landscape of that representation, to have a woman in that office behind that seat, and then a Black woman in particular, you know, as represented by me, as portrayed by myself, it's sort of wow. Wow, I can look back when not too far. I'm still here, still doing, you know, still working. And to know that there really has been a shift and a change that even in the, you know, in a limited series that I find myself in this position, it's like, things do change. You just hang in there.
Yeah, absolutely.
You just stay the course.
Yeah, well, you certainly have done that. Talking of things changing, you know, you would have been in soap operas in the 80s, I think, if I'm to believe your biography. And yet, I was talking to Robert De Niro last week about Zero Day as well. And this is his first time leading a TV series, as you know. Right. And he was just saying, how different TV was. Like when he was an actor in the 80s, TV was this kind of thing you didn't really do unless you know, there was a snobbery about
TV. He was
TV.
Like a stepchild.
Yeah. And now, you know, this is prestige TV. Are you struck by that sometimes? What TV is now? The budgets are bigger than movies.
Yeah, I'm glad to have, you know, started and come along when I did. And I think, you know, timing is everything. And I've certainly had a lot of opportunity. I started out in film and on stage. And yeah. Then sort of, you know, went west where there was television and film, thinking, yeah, I'll get to do both. You know, when you're young, you have, you know, you want to be a dancer and the president. What can I do both? You know, and certainly got to L.A. and it was like, no, you're going to be one or the other. And someone else is going to decide, you know, which arena you're going to find yourself. You're going to get cast here and then you're going to be sort of typecast in that field. But that's. You know, that did not remain true. So he is certainly right. That was sort of the case. And initially I found myself doing a lot of television, a lot of sort of one-offs. And, yeah. You know, once they saw you in that, it was like, well, that's it. You just, and there were only three stations. So it was a very finite number. You know, today you can catch the middle of anything. You have so many choices and opportunity. Yeah. But to see that shift and see, you know, film actors do television and then even stage, you know, and that is just more, you know, there's more ebb and flow back and forth is great because the writers are everywhere. So don't cut yourself off. These were incredible writers that we had for this series. They really have crafted and created a world that is so unpredictable and so many twists and turns, and every character has this backstory and is interesting and intriguing, and you as a viewer aren't quite sure if you're buying into them at the exclusion of another, and it's like, wait a minute, they make a good point also. Yeah. And I just as an actor reading, it's thrilling, it's exciting. Because you can't pin it down, you know. Yeah. Like, I've been around. I know how this is going to go. No, you don't. No, you don't.
No, you don't. No, you don't. The first thing I ever saw you in was Boys in the Hood.
Oh.
And not to make you feel old, but I was a teenager at the time. But say, like a teenager in Ireland, I remember at the time thinking, wow, this is a different America that we haven't seen. You know, South Central LA and a grimy African-American experience. I wonder at the time, did it feel like a big deal to be in a movie like that for you?
Oh, absolutely. Personally, professionally, as an audience member myself, like you said, it was a time when those sort of movies were popular. But Boys in the Hood was by far and above one of the best of that type of movie, a genre movie that was showing young Black America, Black men, women, young people. It was exciting. It was done by a young man himself. He had written out of USC, John Singleton. Yeah. He was 19 years old. It was a time in my career when I was doing just a lot, like I said, a lot of television, like guest starring on this show and that show and this show. And I couldn't break into doing film because it was assumed I was she's a television actor. She's been in television shows. She's a television actor and not a film actor.
Yeah.
But he was just a young, open-minded, bright-eyed, exciting young filmmaker, his first anything. And so he was learning as well. And he was just open, you know. Went in, I think we start talking about Langston Hughes, favorite poets, you know, and he said, "You remind me of my mother." It's like, what a compliment. And and he paired Lawrence Fishburne and myself as his parents. We went on, of course, to do more things together and have a famous movie called Chemistry.
What's Love Got to Do With
It? Exactly. Yeah, yeah. So that was really a turning point. That movie and that movie made such a phenomenal splash and opened like so many eyes, as you said, both in America and in Ireland, in Dublin.
Yeah, Well, that's a perfect place to end. You teasing or complimenting my accent? I'm not sure, but I'll...
I am complimenting my man.
Okay. Wonderful. Well, I'm complimenting Zero Day and all the other great things you did. It's lovely to meet you.
Thank you. You as well.
Angela Bassett and I there engage in a mutual appreciation society where she was, what I thought was teasing my accent, but she said she liked it. And who am I to argue with Angela Bassett? And she was talking there about Boys in the Hood, which was directed by John Singleton. And we didn't actually mention John Singleton sadly passed away in 2019 with a talent still so much to give. So she was talking about Boys in the Hood, but also about Zero Day, which is now on Netflix. 6 episodes. It's a great, great watch. It really is. Up next, the week's new movie releases, including the creepy The Monkey. Now you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. We turn to the week's new cinema releases. Chief among them is the new Stephen King-inspired movie by Osgood Perkins, The Monkey, and also a movie on Apple TV called The Gorge. Delighted to be joined now by regular reviewer on this show, film critic and arts journalist Chris Wasser. Chris, hello.
John, hello. How are you?
Very well. So I haven't seen The Monkey, but it's based on a Stephen King short story. It's from the director who gave us Long Legs, Osgood Perkins, who is, people may know, the son of the great Anthony Perkins. He's kind of the du jour horror director, basically because of Long Legs, right?
I think so, yeah. And I am wondering how long it will take, and I've been doing this quite a lot recently, before people like myself stop reminding listeners and readers that, you know, he is the son of Anthony Perkins. But it is such a huge thing. I mean, your dad was the lead in one of the most famous horrors of all time, and then you have decided to carve out a career as a horror filmmaker. So that's always going to be an interesting point of reference. But I think he is standing on his own two legs now at this point. And Long Legs last year, although far from a perfect chiller, for about an hour, and look, let's face it, that's more than we can say for most horrors, for about an hour, it's pretty damn good. And he made it for, you know, $10 million, which is such a small budget, and it took in $127 million at the box office, and also brought an awful lot of acclaim Nicolas Cage's way. We didn't think we'd guess another film from him so soon, but this is actually the first of two horrors he has out this year, and this one is based on a Stephen King short from 1980.
And it is about an evil monkey.
That's pretty much it, John. Do I even need to give you a plot? No, it's about a monkey, a toy monkey, that you wind up at the back, and he doesn't have cymbals. This one has drums. Once he finishes his little marching drum thing and the toy gives off a little creepy, sinister smile, someone in the room will die. Now, the people who initially play with this toy monkey or keep it in their house, they don't know that. But the monkey has inadvertently been passed down from a scared father. We see Adam Scott playing this terrified airline pilot at the beginning of the film, and everything about him, you know, including or especially the blood-soaked collar, tells us that, you know, he's afraid of this monkey and something bad has happened to him. But he disappears, and his young twin boys, Hal and Bill, played by Christian Covery. So we have got one actor playing the twins as kid and one actor, Theo James, playing them as adults. They're wondering what this toy is. They're wondering who their father was. They never really got to know him. Tatiana Maslany from She-Hulk, she's playing Lois, the abandoned wife and mother, who kind of talks to her kids like adults, and is maybe a little bit heartless in the way she kind of looks at the world and teaches her sons about it. She doesn't stay away from this monkey because clearly I saw your dad at some point horrified by it, and they start playing with it, and they discover pretty soon, John, that when you play with this monkey, as I said, someone dies, and it just haunts them for decades. You know, the first half of the film is them as kids, the second is when they're adults and this monkey is still terrorizing them. That is essentially the setup, and you know what, it's a good one.
Well, yeah, the only thing is, now I haven't seen it, so you tell me, but I mean, that sounds, you know, like the father of schlock B-movie horror.
Oh, it is, yeah. I mean, but that's the thing about, there was a certain B-movie vibe about Long Legs, and Long Legs wasn't the first film that Osgood Perkins had made. And before that, he was kind of doing these, you know, kind of low budget folk horrors. There was a little bit of camp in there as well. I think the difference between this and Long Legs is that for the first time, and also various other horrors that he's given us, is that for the first time, Osgood Perkins is showing us his funny side. And he's decided to, you know, inject this demented sense of humor into proceedings. And I think that's potentially the best decision he could have made. And he's been talking about the fact that this is a film about death, and it's a film about the absurdity of death. And we have Lois telling her boys at the beginning of this film, everybody dies. It's messed up, but they do. And the only real mystery in life is that we're still surprised by that every time it happens. So Osgood Perkins is accepting the fact that both of his parents died under tragic, and especially with his mother, who was in one of the planes that hit the Twin Towers on September 11, 2001. Yeah. He's acknowledging the fact that I have this messed up history when it comes to death. And it's taken me years to get my head around this. Let's make a film about just the absurdity of that. And I think the best way to do it is with a hint of dark humor. There are times in this film, John, where you start to kind of think, this is like a missing chapter from the Final Destination saga. Because people, when the monkey bangs his drum, and what a sentence, people die in the most cruel and unusual ways. We have someone exploding in a swimming pool after they're electrocuted. We have someone literally impaling themselves on a for sale sign outside their house. And every time there's a death, you're just thinking, oh, these are like the really inventive, imaginative deaths from Final Destination. And you know what? I don't think that's as bad a comparison as some listeners might think.
And so, but the monkey then, what you're saying is the the drum banging monkey is a metaphor for death, despite this being a kind of B-movie schlock kind of vibe to it. He's making a grandiose point about the, you know, existential absurdity of life.
I think so. I think you could choose, if you wanted to go into this film thinking, okay, it's about a plastic musical monkey who sends unsuspecting strangers to their graves. You can go with that if you want to, but there's a little bit underneath. And I think Osgood Perkins, he has fleshed out, because this is based on a novella, so there wasn't a whole lot there to work with. But as you know, sometimes the best Stephen King short stories are made for fabulous films, from Shawshank and Green Mile, Tinner, and I could name various others. But there are some messages there. You know, if you look hard enough, you can see that the kids are using this monkey to kind of learn about, you know, because one of the kids at one stage tries to use the monkey to kill someone that they don't like. And they learn very quickly that they are not in control here and that they can't decide those kinds of things. Those monumental decisions are outside of their control. So it is about kids kind of learning to, you know, deal with death and grief. And then as adults, where you've got Theo James having a lot of fun, I should say, playing these two clearly traumatized twins. When they grow up, Hal and Bill, I should say, they are realizing that you can't bury your past. And the only way to kind of, you know, get over, you know, something as traumatic as they've been through, because there are things that happen to them when they're kids that are just horrible, is to stick together. So there is an awful lot going on in here. It just so happens to have, you know, an awful lot of very twisted punchlines, some very gory death sequences. It's quite entertaining. But yeah, if you look hard enough, you'll find a little bit of depth there.
And is the monkey in question scary?
Yeah, John, it's one of those film props where you think to yourself, if that was me, and if I opened that box and I saw that monkey, I would run him wild. But that's why nobody's making a film about me, John. The monkey is quite terrifying. They do have a little bit of fun. And also in the original story, you've got this tiny, it's a miniature, and he bangs cymbals. In this thing, you're talking about, it's a 2-3 foot doll that whose lips move. And when the kids try and destroy it, they realize that it might have actually been a stuffed monkey at one stage. It's kind of an awful lot of effort has gone into the design and also the sound design in this. It's one of those films that to listen to, even it's disturbing. Performance wise as well, again, I mentioned Theo James having a great deal of fun. Tatiana Maslany, who I believe is the lead in Osgood Perkins' next film, which is set in a cabin in the woods, and we'll talk about that later in the year. She's brilliant here. She's just delightful because I don't think we get to see an awful lot more, or we don't get to see an awful lot of her. She's more than She-Hulk. She, for me, was the star of the show.
Yeah, okay, great. So what are you going to say stars-wise for The Monkey, which is in cinemas from this Friday, the 21st of February?
Yeah, I had a lot of fun with this. There are cracks in the storytelling, but I think it's a better, it's a more entertaining and it's a more complete film at times than Long Legs. It's funny, it's fiendish, it stayed with me. I'm going to go with 4.
Okay, 4 stars for The Monkey, which, as I say, is in cinemas from the 21st. Let's take a quick clip.
Things have been a bit messy around here. Yeah, your aunt, of course, was Monday. And then, oh Lord, first thing Tuesday, it was Mitch McDonald. And then Nancy Rizzoli.
There aren't any cobras in Maine. I mean, are there?
Well, there was the one.
A clip there from The Monkey, and he bangs a drum very scarily too, by all accounts. According to Chris Wasser, who's helping me review, well, he's largely doing the heavy lifting. I'm just here, you know, throwing things from the sidelines. However, I have seen the next movie he's reviewing, which is on Apple TV from this Friday also. The Gorge, Chris, about two lonely, I guess they're assassins or marksmen on either side of a gorge.
That's it, yeah. You've got two lonely elite snipers who've been called to do a mission that nobody in their right mind would want to do. And we meet, Miles Teller is playing one assassin and Anya Taylor-Joy is playing another. One of them is American, the other one's Lithuanian. One of them comes with baggage, but Miles Teller's character, Levi, he doesn't really have any connections. He is killed too many people to count. I think his missions have started to take their toll. You know, he's the kind of film assassin who wakes up in the night screaming and sweating. But he's approached by this shady government or shady military figure played by Sigourney Weaver, who says to him, "You don't have any mission, or you don't have anyone in your life who will basically miss you. So that makes you the perfect candidate for this mission where we're going to send you to an undisclosed location on the other side of the world. And we're going to put you up in a watchtower all by yourself. And you are basically going to sit and, you know, play security guard basically over this mysterious gorge." And Anya Taylor-Joy's character, Drossa, she's essentially told the same thing. And it's only from the people who've been in the watchtower before them, without giving too much away, that they quickly learn that they're essentially standing guard over the gates of hell. And there's a wonderful line of dialogue in there, I should say, where, and we're not giving anything away here, this is all in the trailer and the marketing materials, where Levi's predecessor says, "You're not here to stop people going into the gorge. You're here to stop whatever's in the gorge from getting out."
Yeah. And he doesn't know that Anya Taylor-Joy's character is going to be opposite him on almost like a Cold War, you know, "Oh, Nikita," as Elton John might sing, on the other side of the gorge. And they get interested in each other, let's just say.
Yeah, they develop a lovely bond. And that's probably one of the best parts of the film, I think, where one of them fires off a gun when they realize there's a bit of movement across the gorge. And they start using some very advanced binoculars and, you know, music and whatever else they can find to make a sound, most of the time guns, to basically communicate with one another, to wish one another happy birthday and Christmases and all the rest of it.
Yeah. So what did you think of this?
For 40 minutes or so, I was sitting there thinking, I'm in. You know, it's largely silent. It doesn't give much away at the beginning. The bond between these two lonely assassins who, I mean, I think most of the interest between them is the fact that they're not allowed to talk to anyone for months. I think they just check in every 30 days to say, yeah, nothing has come out of the gorge. This is how much ammo I've used. That's about it. So these like two people who've been through an awful lot, finding some sort of connection with each other because, you know, they kind of share the same life. That's pretty well done. That is very well done. And when I didn't know what was in the gorge, I was invested. And it's a great looking film too. It's got an Apple budget behind it. Why wouldn't it be? I think when Scott Derrickson, who's a filmmaker that I admire, you know, I liked what he did with Doctor Strange, The Black Phone was effective for a while. When he lifts that curtain and when he shows you what's in the gorge and when he throws the monsters out and also throws them in, you know, the two characters, it goes bananas. And not in a way that the monkey goes bananas and is still entertaining. It goes bananas in a way that's just too much. And it gets quite dull, I think.
Yeah, you see, I get you up to a point that the monsters beneath or the evil that lurks beneath, that bit went a bit over the top. But I really enjoyed the setup and the premise of it. And I don't want to, you know, say it's a Beckett play because that's overstretching the analogy.
Yeah.
But as you point out, it's very quiet for the first part of the movie and there's very little dialogue and you don't know where this gorge is or almost in a way what timeline this is. Like, is this the Cold War? Is it now? Is it the 70s? Is it the future? So that kind of, I don't know, I forgave some of the nonsense that came later on because I found their relationship quite affecting. But I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth here because I know what you're saying, but I think it was quite unusual, certainly the first half for me, that kind of left me mildly intrigued by the whole thing, you know?
Yeah, As I say, 40-45 minutes, I was with it. But we're talking about a 2-hour, 10-minute sci-fi here, and it is unfortunate that Derrickson, who is he is a good filmmaker, but he just slips and allows the film to just throw careless exposition at you. He kind of over explains everything. The history of the gorge is just silly. I think the worst thing as well, and he has, and it's not just me who picked up on, I'm not just picking up on nothing here, because he has been talking about the fact that he, in creating the visual, when the film goes into the gorge, and again, that's not a spoiler, he wanted to look for inspiration in some very famous sci-fi horror video games. And he is saying that, you know, I think it was Silent Hill. I'm not sure if Resident Evil played a part, but it sometimes looks at it. It's inspired by video games like that. Well, let me say, you can tell, and that's not a good thing, because I do feel as though it kind of lost this very real, I mean, real to an extent, you know, it feels like a drama at the beginning, John. It then becomes this almost shoot 'em up with some weird, gloopy, sloppy CGI creation monster things in the gorge. And I just, that thing didn't really interest me. And, you know, and I thought as well, from the looks of it, it didn't really interest Teller. Anya Taylor-Joy is very good at playing those sci-fi parts and those action hero parts. It really suits her, and she can just do them every day, any day, every day. With Miles Teller, I thought he looked a bit disinterested.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. She's definitely the star of it. What would you say stars-wise for The Gorge?
I think it's going to have to be 2. But again, I'm upset that I'm giving it 2, because it does have such a promising start, and there is a great story here. I mean, this film was on the blacklist, John, for years. Wow. You know,
just to remind people what the blacklist is.
It's basically a list of unproduced screenplays from which various Oscar-winning films have been produced. So, you know, films are written on spec and are just left in, you know, these kind of glorified vaults until someone picks them up and says, why is no one making this? And 9 times out of 10, they win acclaim and awards and all the rest of it and are huge successes. This is not one of those times.
Yeah. Well, look, I would give it 3 because, as I say, the setup really intrigued me. I get what you're saying about when it takes a severe action turn, it does get a bit bananas, not in a good way, but it held me for the 2 hours plus. So that's a miserly 2, even though he doesn't want to do it for The Gorge from Chris Wasser. I'm giving it 3. It is on Apple TV from this Friday, the 21st of February. Chris, thanks a lot.
Cheers, John.
Chris Wasser there, reviewing the week's new releases, including The Gorge and The Monkey. That is it for this week. Thank you for listening. If you want to get in touch with me at any stage, John_Fardy is my Twitter handle, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on Newstalk. Going to leave you with a little music from the movies. And this week, I went to play it last week, but we ran out of time. From the new Bridget Jones movie, Mad About the Boy, which is going gangbusters in cinemas. I do say gangbusters a lot, but hey, it's a phrase I like. Very evocative. And this song by David Bowie features predominantly in the great soundtrack in the new Bridget Jones movie. So I leave you with the great David Bowie and wish you a happy remainder to your weekend.
Screen Time with John Fardy.
Thanks to Airtainment.
Saturdays at 6 p.m. on News Talk.